Howdy, folks. This is Phil Hudock, and it's August 13th. This is the 11th program of Prove All Things. All programs are accessible on my website, hudock.info. These programs air on Channel 3 every Thursday night at 6 p.m. On Thursday, August 6th, I gave a presentation under public comments to the Randolph County Commission. I addressed the county commission with concerns about the policies, ramifications, the lack of consistency, and the apparent lying to the public concerning COVID-19. We, the people, are ultimately responsible for good and honest government. It is imperative to bring to the attention of our representatives any important information we are privy to and that they are unaware of.
Call a meeting to order for agenda business. Public comment. I think there's one. Phil?
I thank the commissioners for the opportunity for the public to speak and to address you and the newspaper, the media, which we certainly need, the Fourth Estate, and I see the mayor's here, so, and we have protection, so. I guess we haven't cut the funds of the city police, so that's good. I'm looking for truth, and I'm sure you folks are. Any information that I receive, I'm responsible for, and likewise you do too. And this is where really government meets the road, where the tire meets the pavement. I have in front of you there a publication that came out May 5th, 2020, from the CDC. It's over 1,000 pages. It is peer-reviewed, and there were, I would say, probably hundreds of people that were involved in producing this report by the CDC. In one section of it, pages 853 to 1,054, is titled "Emerging Infectious Diseases." So you have this there. Mm-hmm. On page 972, under the conclusion of what they found on face masks, is there, and I'd like to read it. This is from the CDC, this year in May. "We did not find evidence that surgical type face masks are effective in reducing laboratory confirmed influenza transmission, either when worn by infected persons, source control, or by persons in the general community to reduce their susceptibility. However, as with hand hygiene, face masks might be able to reduce the transmission of other infections when healthcare resources are stretched." I've been studying vaccinations, I've been studying flu clear back since 1976, and the last, I think I have a picture there of an image from my website of a documentary that I actually posted on my website. It's 60 minutes on swine flu and vaccinations in 1976. Hundreds of people and millions of dollars of government money was paid to people who suffered consequences. This episode, which I purchased from 60 Minutes and posted, was on the internet for 11 years. Then, on March 12th, I noticed the CDC put a flyer on my video posting saying, get the latest information about COVID-19. They did this on anyone who had any ideas about or wanted to express what they felt. And I got lots of people watching this, and then they removed it. They scrubbed it. It's gone. We have censorship in this country that is beyond belief. I had to go to another channel. I am not even on YouTube anymore. I've been censored. So I went to a channel called Brighteon. And now they're censoring Brighteon, where I can't even link something to Facebook from Brighteon. Because guess who owns Facebook, YouTube. So I'm glad the press is here, and I hope they cover this. The last five or six times I've been here, it didn't actually make the newspaper. When someone comes in for $100 for a jazz concert somewhere, you know, that makes the newspaper. And I think this is important, and I've studied this. And that's why I'm videotaping it, and that's why I'm playing it on Channel 3. And I've given you a program that I recorded this morning. Actually, part of it goes back 4 years ago when I actually addressed millions of people on Coast to Coast AM. I was being interviewed by a researcher by the name of John Rappaport, a very smart, influential man. And that's going to play on Channel 3 this evening. I want you to look at it. I want you to invite me back, because I don't want to have to come in here and do 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, and 5 minutes to tell you things that I know. My pastor has interviewed some of the best authorities in this country. I can get you their personal numbers if you want to talk to them. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, a pediatrician in Ohio. Dr. Judy Mikovits, who suffered persecution from Mr. Fauci. So, like I say, I just ask you to look at that. I'm just a resource. You folks are our government, local government. We are in a mess. We are in a mess. And this is the biggest hoax I've ever seen. Back in 2009, when the swine flu hoax hit again, which was turned out to be less than the actual regular flu. By the way, has anyone heard any numbers on the regular flu? No, you won't hear a peep. And my students from Pickens went to the Helvetia Clinic that had the flu in 2009. When they came back, I said, which flu did you have? And they said, well, they didn't test us for it. They told us they were just supposed to record it as the swine flu. And I was like, I don't believe this. Medical professionals are just putting down something that they don't know whether it's true or not. I'm looking for truth, folks. I think you should, too. So I thank you for this time. I'm at your service. May God help us.
In Prove All Things number 10, which aired on August 6th, I showed a group of doctors who spoke in front of the U.S. Supreme Court building. One of those doctors was Dr. Simone Gold. It's interesting what happened to Dr. Simone Gold. The Tuesday, August 11th, Intermountain on page 5 has an article titled, Health Officials Are Quitting or Getting Fired Amid Pandemic. I'm going to read the first 4 paragraphs of this article in the Intermountain, and then show you proof positive that indeed some whistleblowers, some doctors, some health professionals have actually been fired because they're trying to bring important information to the people. Providence, Rhode Island. Vilified, threatened with violence, and in some cases suffering from burnout, dozens of state and local public health officials around the U.S. have resigned or have been fired amid the coronavirus outbreak. A testament to how politically combustible masks, lockdowns, and infection data have become. One of the latest departures came Sunday when California Public Health Director Dr. Sonia Angel quit without explanation following a technical glitch that caused a delay in reporting virus test results. Information used to make decisions about reopening businesses and schools. Last week, New York City's health commissioner was replaced after months of friction with the police department and City Hall. A review by the Kaiser Health News Service and the Associated Press finds at least 49 state and local public health leaders have resigned, retired, or been fired since April across 23 states. The list has grown by more than 20 people since the AP and KHN started keeping track in June.
This is America First, and here's your host, Dr. Sebastian Gorka.
The truth is a good thing, is it not? One should be rewarded for speaking the truth. Unless, of course, it has something to do with a certain pandemic that came to us out of China. I'm Sebastian Gorka, former strategist to President Trump, and this is America First. And I'm delighted to have with us somebody who not only worked for the Surgeon General of the United States, is a board-certified emergency medicine specialist, but also, and this is really impressive, you go to med school, you get certified, and then you go to Stanford and you get your JD. That's enough. But it wasn't for her. She's Dr. Simone Gold, and she is the founder of American Doctors Who Are On The Front Line. They had a summit here last week, a totally viral video. We had Dr. Dan Erickson, one of her colleagues, on the show. The video was deep-sixed almost immediately. She appeared on my colleague Dennis Prager's show, and now she's gracing us with her presence. Dr. Gold, welcome to America First.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here, Dr. Gorka.
First things first, you made an appearance on Fox News, and you said that you'd lost your job after you held your summit. Do tell, what exactly happened after you came here just to speak factually about the Chinese COVID virus?
Yes, I was told that because I had appeared in an embarrassing video speaking about hydroxychloroquine, that my services would no longer be needed.
And so what does that mean? Are you without a job, or was this a clinic you were working for? So can you tell us more?
Yeah, so just to be really clear, I am a board-certified emergency physician practicing on the front lines, whether or not there's a pandemic. There's been some chatter in social media that maybe I'm not a real doctor. I most definitely am. I'm the person you see if you break your leg or you need to be intubated for COVID. That's me. And I work at a couple of different hospitals, which is common for emergency doctors. And at one hospital, I was getting a tremendous amount of grief for prescribing hydroxychloroquine. At the other, it was a little less profile and they didn't fuss as much, but they both let me go.
Okay. And did they say what you did that was wrong, Dr. Gold?
You know, it's just medical cancel culture. I don't even begrudge my hospitals any more than any other hospitals. I think this is any hospital USA. This is how we are.
But were you given a reason what you did that was wrong or against the ethics of the medical profession?
No, it was flat out said to me that it was because of the video that I appeared in. That's what I was told, flat out.
Did they say what was wrong with the video?
No, just that it was embarrassing.
Okay, so for those who haven't seen the video, what was your video at American Frontline Doctors? What was it about?
So our website was taken down, so it's going up soon so people can see for themselves. But we had a summit. It was 3.5 hours in the morning and 3.5 hours in the afternoon of educational content related to COVID, because we know that the American people have been gravely misled. In between, we did a press conference on the steps of the Supreme Court, and that got the most attention because we're calling attention to the fact that there is treatment. There are options. The fear that has captivated Americans is not justified. So that's what we're here to tell you.
So let's talk about one thing you mentioned, that you were given grief before you were fired for prescribing hydroxychloroquine. I've been taking hydroxychloroquine for months. It's been around since the 1950s. The U.S. government prescribed it to our soldiers in Vietnam. Why is it suddenly, why are governors of the United States, Dr. Gold, banning the use of this established generic drug?
Right. So it's so incredibly bizarre and unique that no matter what you think, you have to at least notice that this has never happened before, that an FDA approved medication for 65 years, widely available on the WHO's list of essential medications that all countries must have for all time. It was a derivative of quinine, which is found in tree barks, the most non-controversial of drugs. All of a sudden, governors and state pharmacy boards and state medical boards and the government really cares about this drug. It's very, very bizarre.
Do you have any theory as to why it is now public enemy number one?
Yes. So it's so clear that it's safe. There's no debate whatsoever. The only debate that ever existed, if it worked, and that's absolutely been settled. The science is very clear that it works. So you have to say to yourself, if you knock out the best early contender, the drug that will work early in the disease. The people that benefit are the people that offer products relating to other stages, like late disease. So that would be remdesivir, Gilead. It would be vaccines, right? By the way, you cannot do an emergency use authorization for, you know, vaccines, for example, if there's another available medication. That's an interesting little point of law. You can't go quickly through the process if there's another treatment. So I know that if hydroxychloroquine was on label, the options to move other drugs to the front of the line as an emergency cease to exist.
It's an old question. It's a Latin question, but it's an important one. Cui bono? Who benefits? I'm Sebastian Gorka. We are talking to Dr. Simone Gold. Follow her on Twitter, Dr. Simone Gold, and her website, AFLDS.com. That's American Frontline Doctors Summit, AFLDS.com.
There's an old saying in Tennessee, I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, we can't get fooled again.
In 2010, Forbes magazine accurately reported on the WHO's fraudulent response to the swine flu. The Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe declared the false pandemic is one of the greatest medicine scandals of the century. By their own rules, a pandemic requires simultaneous epidemics worldwide with enormous numbers of deaths and illness. 11 weeks into the outbreak, only 144 people died worldwide, and the WHO declared a pandemic. Just 1 month before, they changed the rules. You could now have a pandemic with zero deaths. And when questioned, they claimed the old rule never existed.
Now, there is some confusion here, and I hope to clarify. Having severe death has never been part of the WHO pandemic.
The WHO director, Dr. Margaret Chan, then went on to push left-wing politics, the redistribution of wealth for equity and social justice, and claimed that a welfare state is the savior of globalism. Over $18 billion was misallocated on this fake pandemic. In 2005, Dr. Peter Doshi published a paper entitled, Are U.S. Flu Death Figures More PR Than Science?, drawing upon data from the CDC. The CDC bundles together influenza and pneumonia and counts them together, which is strange because according to their own data, there are far more deaths caused by pneumonia than the flu. For example, out of the 62,000 pneumonia and influenza deaths from 2001, only 18 cases were lab-confirmed influenza, 0.03%. From 1979 to 2002, there were an average of 58 influenza deaths per year. In 2004, CDC Director Glenn Nowak gave a presentation wherein he called upon the media to state concern and alarm, predict dire outcomes, and urge influenza vaccination. The Flu Protection Act of 2005 required the Secretary of Health and Human Services to conduct public influenza awareness campaigns preceding every flu season. Sales of the flu vaccine began skyrocketing, bringing in billions of dollars to the manufacturers, all for something that kills, on average, less than 100 people a year. In 2007, the New York Times published an article entitled, Faith in Quick Test Leads to Epidemic That Wasn't. It explains how the same PCR tests being used now for COVID-19 misdiagnosed over 100 healthcare workers in New Hampshire and rang the bell for a whooping cough epidemic that turned out to just be the common cold. The PCR tests were never meant to detect a specific virus, and yet they are being used today to detect COVID-19. The CDC even admits that the PCR test will detect any viral infection as COVID-19, including the common cold. The current data from the CDC on COVID-19 shows the same fakery that we have seen so far. Just as the CDC falsely counted pneumonia deaths as influenza deaths in the past, they are now counting both pneumonia and influenza as COVID-19. You can see it clearly in the CDC's own data. Beginning in the end of March, right after the shutdown began in the U.S., pneumonia and influenza deaths dropped to zero, just as COVID deaths began to surge. COVID-19 is a quantifiable hoax. After years of unchecked big pharma fraud, we are witnessing their greatest swindle yet. And the amount of people wearing the mask only illustrates how effective their scam is. Will the mask wearers take the experimental vaccine for fear of what amounts to be the common cold? For InfoWars.com, this is Greg Reese.
You know, we'll have to prepare for the next one. That, you know, I'd say is, will get attention
this time.
March 31st, 2025 is when the whole procedure finishes. You won't need cash anymore. You won't even need your smartphone anymore. You will be paying with your face. The next 5 years are going to see complete restructuring of this entire social system, and it's going to be worldwide. There's no countries that are going to escape from this. It's the entire world is going to go through this change, folks. Well, they're really pushing the second wave. They're bringing in mandatory face masks in Victoria. Now they're saying the second wave is going to be tougher to deal with, of course, than the first wave. But this is just the beginning, folks. It's not going to go away. I said that months ago, this is not going to go away. They're going to release the lockdown a little bit and then they're going to ramp it up even more. People think that, you know, this is just a temporary thing. No, it's not. They'll find ways of extending it, but they've got to do it in ways that the people are going to go along with. So they've got to do it gradually like this, and they've got to do it under the guise of this. It's the only way they can really get away with it. It's the only way they can get people to buy into it. It's all very well for us to be pushing back, but if we don't wake up the people around us, they're going to drag us into it, whether we want to go into it or not. There's also a new action called Protect Our Neighbours, folks. You know, they're wonderful, aren't they? They want you to spy on your neighbours, basically, folks. Like I said, all the sleeping masses are the ones who are going to drag us into this if we're not careful. So there's now a new program whereby you can protect your neighbours by keeping an eye on them and making sure they're social distancing. Basically spying on them and dobbing them in if they're doing the wrong thing under the guise of protecting them. You know, they're doing what they can to continue to push this whole concept of the second wave. Of course, the more people they test, then the more people are going to test positive because they're just testing for RNA viruses and genetic material. And, you know, the people that are testing, the people that they're labeling as dying from are not even deaths. And there's a lot of people speaking out about this now as well. And this is happening everywhere. It isn't just in the UK. It's happening in the United States. It's happening in Australia. All deaths are basically being labeled as deaths now, whether they are or not. All you have to do is test positive for this genetic material in your body, and they'll save you. And it doesn't matter if you get hit by a truck. They'll still put you down as a death simply because you tested positive for this genetic material at some stage. And they don't even know if the genetic material you tested positive for is actually, because there's never been a Koch's postulate done. They've never isolated or actually identified this virus as actually existing. So the whole thing's just a big scam, folks. But, you know, that's why they're getting their second wave, because they're pushing this testing. They're making the testing mandatory. And anybody they test is pretty well going to come up positive. I mean, if a pawpaw can come up positive, if engine oil can come up positive, if you can send tests in that haven't even had anybody's, sample put on them and they still come back positive, then pretty well anybody and anything is going to test positive, folks. Most people have had a flu vaccine will test positive. So That's how they're getting their second wave. It's just media driven. There is no second wave because there wasn't a first wave. There is no, folks, it's a complete scam. It's all about crashing the world economic system. And it's going to get crazier and crazier yet. What they want to do, you know, the COVID pass. I mentioned to you a few reports ago, the COVID pass they want to bring in, the mandatory pass that everybody needs to have to show they're infection-free, all the stuff they want to do. They're trialing it in Africa now. They're calling it a trust pass. Isn't that nice? A trust pass to make sure you're vaccinated. A vaccination record payment system is what they're talking about. This is the payment system. They want you to be scanned, retinal scanned, facial scanned, biometric scans, and that's how you're going to be paying. You won't need cash anymore. You won't even need your smartphone anymore. You will be paying with your face. And of course, you'll need a record of vaccination in order to enter the store to begin with. And that's the way they want to play it, folks. March 31st, 2025 is when the whole procedure finishes. Interesting date, folks, 2025. We are set to be in a very, very different reality to what we are now. By 2025, the whole system will be controlled by AI. That's the way it's going. If you can understand AI, and you can understand that AI is working to gain control for itself, then you understand how these computer models work and why they're so, you know, over the top. But if you can think of a way of controlling and corralling human beings, then it all begins to make sense. It doesn't matter if the figures are wrong. They just want human consciousness to go in a certain way. And they want to merge us with the machine. And, you know, the question is, who is they? And when you look at it, folks, it's like they is now AI. The AI is already there. You know, we're waiting for artificial intelligence to emerge, but really it's already emerged, folks. It's already there online. Artificial intelligence is already a reality. We're just not looking at things the right way. And what it's doing is it's basically creating a system whereby we are going to be completely dependent upon artificial intelligence in order to survive, in order to perform everyday activities, even going outside and purchasing a meal. You're going to need the whole thing controlled by artificial intelligence to be able to move through that reality, through the new world they're creating. You know, the politicians, I don't even think the politicians know exactly what they're doing. I think too many people who've been involved in setting this up really bargained for what they were going to be getting. But it's going to get crazier and crazier yet. This whole economic system, it's going to go down so hard. The government's now saying, oh, we may have misjudged how bad the economic situation is going to be. No, they haven't misjudged anything. They already knew how bad the economic situation was going to be, which is why they did all this, to cover up how bad the economic situation is going to be. They have to crash the economy, but provide an excuse for it to crash that doesn't look like it was them when it was. In 2025, when the internet becomes fully autonomic on its own and it controls things itself, the world is going to change and our relationship with the internet is going to change. In 2015, we kind of got to the point of no return, the point where we are becoming so dependent upon the internet and so dependent upon electronic systems to manage our everyday affairs, we've kind of crossed that Rubicon. And it's only going to become more and more dependent. We're just going to see a situation where our dependency is increased upon all this technology. And that's going to go up till about 2025 when we're going to be completely dependent upon it. And at that point, the internet itself takes control of things and then it decides who can and cannot access the internet. I mean, I really think that's the way it's going to go, folks. Prepare to step out of the system altogether, or at least be ready to be able to step out of the system around about 2025, because, you know, I think that is our window of opportunity. The next 5 years are going to be very, very telling, folks. The next 5 years are going to see complete restructuring of this entire social system, and it's going to be worldwide. There's no countries that are going to escape from this. It's the entire world is going to go through this change, folks. And we are at the tipping point right now. So, yeah, I think it's important for people to pay attention, folks. And if you're not going to get angry and stand up and do something about this, then at least get prepared for the future that is unfolding, you know, because if we don't change it, it's just going to unfold and we're going to get dragged into it by all the sleeping masses. That's just the way it is. So, you know, we have to be prepared to either go with that or have some plan B where we are in a position where we can step out of that system and step back into reality, step back into a relationship with the earth.
If someone had said to you in December that by April, millions of people all over the world would be infected with a mysterious new virus that has no vaccine, you'd think they were talking about a Hollywood script. It's happened so fast, it almost doesn't seem real.
A new normal.
A new normal.
A new normal.
A new normal.
New normal.
The new normal.
The new normal.
The new normal.
New normal.
This new normal is going to look very, very different.
Not normal, but a new normal.
The new normal.
New normal.
There will be a new normal.
A new normal.
New normal.
A new normal.
The new normal.
A new normal.
This is the new normal.
This is our new normal.
Our new normal.
A new normal.
Our new normal.
New normal.
The new normal.
Our new normal.
We will transition into the new normal.
Only 42% will submit. Submit to what? You're going to have to stay tuned to find out. These numbers are down dramatically. I'm stunned at this. The government has a big, big enforcement problem on their hands. And the results on this these polls are pretty consistent now. And we're going to get into what it is Dave Hodges is talking about. But I'm sure somewhere in some government building at the CDC, they're saying, wow, we have a problem, Houston. May do. My name is Dave Hodges. I'm the host of The Common Sense Show. We are the show that is freeing America one enslaved mind at a time. Here's what the data is telling us. Only 42% of the people say they'll willingly take the coronavirus shot. I think a lot of those people will fold at the first sign of pressure. You can't go to your house. You can't go to your job. You can't go to the movies. You can't do this. You can't do that. You could probably go to a casino, but you wouldn't be able to do anything else. There'll be about half of the 58% that'll say, okay, I don't want to, but ooh. Okay, that's what they're going to do. But there's a significant number of people that look like they're going to say no. And even if you have a 10% refusal rate, that's a huge number. That involves over 33 million people. 20%, that's 66 million people. 30%, now you're almost up to 100 million. 42%, uh-oh. Houston, we have a problem. Red alert, red alert, red alert. The heat shield is loose. We might burn up on reentry. This is what they're facing. If you get this much widespread issues, here's what will happen. Okay, and I'm just speaking strictly from sociology. When you have multiple issues that a country and a people are dealing with, if you give them that one rallying point, one point to rally around, it'll spread to the other areas. Because if we can say no about this, we're going to say no to a lot of things. Now, right now, America's wearing a mask. And it looks like America's made the decision there's a big difference between the mask and taking the vaccine. Now, I've also got to say this too. We really have to be scientific on this. Do you know what's in the vaccine? For sure. Do you know? Have you read the ingredients? Then how can you say you won't take something if you don't know what's in it? That's true for a lot of people. Now, some people come back and say, Dave, they got nanocytes and bots and blah, blah, blah. Okay, I hear you. And if you believe that's true, if you believe your information's accurate, okay, God bless you. But there are a lot of people that are just stubbornly saying, I ain't taking it. Okay? You sound kind of ignorant if you don't have some reasons. It's my right. Okay, now you got a reason.
Do you have a right to decide what you're going to put in your body? And does society have a right to isolate you and quarantine you if you don't, if you're a danger to others? And does COVID-19 pose that kind of threat? I mean, it is kind of interesting, isn't it, that you have to take a test to find out if you got the virus. Has anyone ever thought of that? You have to take the test to find out if you have the virus? You'd think there'd be bodies in the street the way we're reacting. But anyway, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. There'll be part of me when this goes on, I'll be saying, I'm shocked beyond belief. I can't believe my country is at this place. It's terribly depressing. And as someone who has an undergraduate background in sociology, I'm going to say, wow, this is really interesting. The dynamics of force and control and compliance and resistance are all going to come into play. And we're going to get to see it right here. Right here. It's a hell of a price to pay, though, isn't it? Maybe I should do a dissertation on this. Maybe you should stand up and join the 42% and say, you have to prove safety. You have to prove efficacy. Does it work? If you do that, okay, you have my support. If you just blanketly say, I ain't taking it, if you don't have a reason, there's no support there. We'll see you back here next time. Thanks for joining us.
You can't kill an idea, but ideas can kill you. What if I told you that this has all happened before? The riots, the violence, the church burning, attacks on police, destruction of private property, all in the name of equality. What is the deadliest thing mankind has ever encountered in world history? Is it disease, famine, nuclear weapons? Not even close. By sheer body count, it's an idea. This is the story of the deadliest virus in the world. Communism. The year is 1848. Europe is burning. Political upheaval leads to mass violent riots in over 50 countries. Buildings burn, shops are looted, and national militias are called in to quell the mob. Sound familiar? This year, an obscure socialist named Karl Marx publishes the Communist Manifesto. The Communist Manifesto outlines how to destroy capitalism and usher in communism through the means of socialism. To accomplish this goal, the manifesto pits two groups against each other based on their identity. Bourgeois versus proletariat. Essentially, business owners versus the workers of that business. See, identity hatred is the key component that makes communism work. The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles, Marx writes. Today, we would call this identity politics. The principle is the same. Define people by their groups and pit them against each other with a perceived injustice, and then violence. Marx embraces violence. He calls for the forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions and for the common ruin of the classes. What we are left with after this violent class warfare is a communist state. Marx spells out plainly what this looks like. Complete state ownership of your life. No private property, high taxes, government control of communications and media, government jobs for workers, government income for all workers, mandatory government education, and government that supersedes the church in power. These are the programs that the left is pushing today, nearly 200 years after the writing of the Communist Manifesto. And they're using identity politics and, yes, violence to do it. Remember, this is about power and control. In 1917, Marx's ideas got their big shot. Vladimir Lenin was a Russian Marxist living in exile in Switzerland during World War I. Lenin believed wholeheartedly in communism and saw the Russian political upheaval during the war as his shot to create a communist state. Shockingly, when Lenin asked the German military for passage to Russia in the midst of a war between the two countries, Germany enthusiastically said yes. The Germans treated Lenin and his communism as a deadly weapon to be used against their Russian enemy, a virus to infect the opponent and cripple them. The Germans agreed to transport Lenin across the front lines into Russia, but only via a sealed train, so Lenin and his virus could not break out into Germany. Unleashing the deadly weapon of communism on the Russian people was a horrifically effective tactic. As soon as Lenin arrived in Russia, he began to employ identity politics and social justice as a potent tool in his civil war. Lenin told his armed revolutionaries in 1918,
Comrade, hang. And I mean hang so that the people can see. Not less than 100 known rich men. Do this so that for hundreds of miles around, the people can see, tremble, know, and cry. They are killing and will go on killing.
Lenin won using identity politics to pit groups against each other, incite violence, create anarchy, and then the virus took hold.
Private property and businesses were immediately dissolved. Freedom of speech eliminated. Individual freedoms crushed. Economic collapse. Famine. Starvation. Secret police raids. Millions of Russians sent to concentration camps.
More people were sent to concentration camps in communist Russia than in Nazi Germany. In spite of practiced horrors in Russia, communism spread, and always by force.
Eastern Europe, China, Vietnam, Cambodia, North Korea, Cuba, and parts of Africa fell to communist revolutions and dictators.
It's critical to note, this mass death is not caused by foreign forces, but from within. Communism kills in the name of equality. They kill their own people. Communists do not care. They are indifferent to the suffering. Man-made famines and mass starvation in concentration camps are the norm, the cost of social justice. The death toll numbers under communism are staggering.
Eastern Europe, 1 million. Vietnam, 1 million. Afghanistan, 1.5 million. Africa, 1.7 million. North Korea, 2 million. Cambodia, 2 million. Soviet Russia, 20 million people.
But nowhere is the genocidal, sociopathic bloodlust of communism more evident than the dark history of communist China. China became a communist state in 1949 after a bloody, prolonged civil war led by Mao Zedong. After becoming a communist dictator, Mao joked about the killing of business owners in his own country. 30 million people.
We have so many people. We can afford to lose a few. Mao's attempt to industrialize China, known as the Great Leap Forward, murdered more than 45 million people in a few short years, many simply from starvation.
A total of 65 million Chinese nationals were murdered under Mao's communism. Mao kept power in spite of the genocide. Communists never give up power, ever.
They don't have to. The state is God and you are nothing. Mao's political party remains in power in China to this day, and they exercise an ironclad grip on its people.
The Communist Party of China's failed response to the coronavirus cost many innocent people their lives.
The virus outbreak, most likely from incompetent management of their own viral labs, was made exponentially worse by the communist regime's inability to admit wrongdoing and warn the rest of the world. These actions directly led to the global spread of the deadly virus, resulting in the deaths of tens of thousands of Americans.
But as always, with communism, the worst is yet to come. Many of the organized leftists torching American cities are Marxists. They admit it, they say so. And they are practicing the tenets of communism to the letter.
We are trained Marxists. We are super versed on sort of ideological theories.
Use identity and class division to destroy private property in the name of justice. Demonize capitalists. Publicly persecute those who disagree with you. Incite violence and seize power and control.
In 1932, Stalinist-backed communists in Germany formed a group to violently clash with police, terrorize the public, and physically assault their political enemies in the street. The name of that group?
Antifasciste Acton, Antifa. This was their symbol. Their tactics have now moved to our streets, and so have their motivations.
Vladimir Lenin and Karl Marx both agreed. The goal of socialism is communism. Power and control. It is always about power and control. What is happening right now in America is not new. In fact, it's centuries old. The tactics are meant to bewilder you and make you question your institutions. They're meant to divide us and raise what we know as America to the ground. It's a revolution by the deadliest virus known to man. Communism. You can't kill an idea, but ideas can kill you. We must fight this virus to survive.
just a fake silhouette, avoiding every threat. I want to stay like a silhouette, but I can't do that. No, I can't do that.
Hey, internet friends. The school year is starting back, and like most happenings in 2020, the situation is just not the same as it was in years prior, since parents are now faced with a challenging decision. Whether or not to send their child back to in-person school, keep them at home with the school's distance learning program, or homeschool them with a custom curriculum. Regardless of what you might decide for yourself and your family, today I want to talk about something I was never taught in school, public or private, and that's the pivotal year that everything changed for the United States of America, creating a domino effect of events that have led us to this moment in time, right now, as you're watching this. The year was 1871, and while the events of this year have been purposefully hidden from the masses, 1871 must never be forgotten. Much like Vatican City and the City of London, Washington, D.C. has its own sovereignty. Basically, D.C., City of London, and Vatican City are totally separate territories from the nations in which they reside. Vatican City is technically enclaved within Rome, outfitted with its own special police force and political structure. The same way the City of London is situated within the city called London, and it has its own flag, crest, police force, ceremonial armed forces, and a mayor. And sure, there are states within the United States that have their own constitution and distinctive flags, but I think most people you'd ask would know that Washington, D.C. isn't a state. Most folks would tell you that Washington, D.C. is where our laws are made, where our politicians congregate, and where our White House resides. But on the D.C. flag, which is said to have been reflective of George Washington's coat of arms, there are three stars. And I wonder, are those stars representative of the three city-states that exist as corporate entities outside of their respective nations? Vatican City, the religious hub, the City of London, the banking central, and Washington, D.C., the military leg of the empire. Being its own city-state, D.C. has its own police force that shares a direct link with Congress, its own mayor, and its own set of laws. But our founding fathers certainly didn't set it up like this, so how did it come to be? The year was 1871. The U.S. was going through a lot of turmoil. The nation was bankrupt and vulnerable after the Civil War, and the London bankers, which included the notorious Rothschild family, were ready to make a deal with Congress to remedy that turmoil. Turmoil, I might add, that is suspected that the bankers had a hand in creating in the first place. At any rate, these bankers made a lot of credit available in the aftermath of the Civil War as a means to, one, fight Lincoln's greenback after he was murdered, with some theorizing that part of the motivation for his assassination came from his push to privatize the monetary system. And the second reason that the bankers made so much credit available was to collect on the interest from those who desperately needed the money, which would be the United States government at the time. Now, this was nothing new. This was a practice as old as time. Well, as old as Mystery Babylon. Not much has really changed since the days of Babylon. Not the usury, not the debt slavery, not even the iconography. Passed by Congress, the Act of 1871 provided a government for the 10-mile parcel of land known as the District of Columbia, allowing Washington, D.C. to act as a corporation outside of the original Constitution of the United States. So, okay, why does the Washington, D.C. Constitution have nothing to do with the United States Constitution? Why exactly is Washington, D.C. totally separate from the rest of the United States? Why does it need to be separate from the United States as a separate territory at the epicenter of the Virgin Mary, tucked right between Virginia and Maryland? The Act of 1871 changed our country's founding fathers' original constitution for the United States for America to the Constitution of the United States of America. If you blink, you might miss it because it's a mixture of impactful wording and some weird capitalization thrown in there that pretty much means nothing to the average person upon initial inspection. But these subtle changes are a huge deal in the realm of legislation. Compounded with these minor changes was clever marketing of the act as a way to unify the territorial government for the entire District of Columbia. The aforementioned are contributing factors as to how such a major act flew under the radar, ultimately overturning the United States Constitutional Republic. Since 1871, the federal government has usurped nearly all of the power that was formerly held in the hands of the people. But how on earth was Congress able to pass a separate constitution and incorporate the United States? A bunch of attorneys have contacted me about the subject, explaining it to me. Thank you for everyone who's done that. But let me break it down to you in a way that won't make you just totally fall asleep. A corporation, by definition, is a legal entity separate from its owners. A corporation protects its owners from personal liability for corporate debts and obligations within limits. So was the Act of 1871 as harmless as some claim? Just an act to provide a government for the District of Columbia and nothing more? We can answer that question by simply stepping back and taking a look at the dominoes that fell after this act was passed, and asking the question, who benefited from this piece of legislation? Is the Act of 1871 the reason why Congress passed the 16th Amendment, which allowed the federal government to tax individual personal income regardless of state population? Is the Act of 1871 the reason why the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 was passed, handing over America's gold and silver reserves and ultimately the total control of America's economy to the Federal Reserve Bank? Think about it. A private corporation established their private bank, acting as the central bank of the United States, but it isn't even a government institution, but a privately owned banking system. Is it a coincidence that Social Security numbers started being assigned in 1935, Social Security numbers being the 9-digit numbers given to every U.S. citizen, and used for income tracking and taxation purposes? Ultimately, individual income taxes have been the primary source of revenue for the U.S. federal government since the 1950s. These moves make a lot of sense when examined through the lens of the United States as a corporation and its citizens as employees, a corporate government asset before they even go through puberty. But still, throughout all this time, there was a promise that the American dollar was actually worth something. Something tangible, not just the confidence to exchange it for goods and services. A dollar was worth 1/35 an ounce of gold. But then President Richard Nixon came along and screwed that up for us, severing the final link between the dollar and gold in 1971. In other words, he took the dollar off the gold standard once and for all. Steadily, the purchasing power of the dollar has declined while federal and consumer debt has increased. Currently, we're witnessing the culmination of all of these decisions, and it ain't pretty. We're one bad flu season removed from Weimar Republic wheelbarrow money. So who would you say benefited from the Act of 1871? The average U.S. citizen, or the bankers who incorporated the United States, who have been buying politicians ever since? The same Federal Reserve who serves absolutely no real function except stealing the purchasing power of your 60-plus hour work week and then redistributing those funds to destroy your rights and enslave you on your own soil. Hey, just like they did back in Babylon, it's the same folks using the same debt slavery system, time after time. When will we learn that debt with interest is a system of perpetual debt and is continually passed on to the people beneath until the debt gap consumes all but those who own the debt? Well, like I said in the beginning of this video, the most pivotal year in United States history was never taught to me in school, public or private, and never taught to me at a college level. But as Americans, it's so important that we not let this information die with our generation. One of the most important lessons you can teach your children is how to obtain their own freedom, how to identify when their freedoms are being taken from them, and how to demand those personal freedoms and liberties back, instead of waiting around for a hero in the form of a politician to represent them, to offer solutions. During this time, we've seen people of all ages crying out for change. And instead of focusing on the changes we could make that could fundamentally change the United States for the better, especially on an individual level, politicians are selling socialism and communism, aka more government control, to young people looking for an answer, and they beg for it because the future seems so bleak. Whether you play with paper or with digital money, the future will always be bleak if you're a debt slave. If before your foot even touches this earth, you're scanned into the system as an employee of this corporation who does not care about you one bit. The United States is still a great country, but it has its problems, and you know you can riot and loot and protest all you want, but until the Federal Reserve is ended, until the Act of 1871 is torn into 1,000 pieces and thrown into the wind, until the IRS is abolished, and until we move back to the gold standard, we have no chance at experiencing any iota of freedom. What do you think, internet friends? Did you know about the Act of 1871? You know, I always look forward to reading your comments. Thank you so much for sharing this video, for subscribing, and for supporting my channel on Patreon. Bye!
And it makes me very happy to see people being properly represented for a change. But during the course of the next 4 years, we will bring our pharmaceutical and medical supply chains home. We're going to bring them home where they belong. And we'll end reliance on China, just like we did with the washers and dryers, just like we did with many other things. We'll be making our product here safely, beautifully, and inexpensively. We're reasserting American economic independence, and I've been doing that from the first day I came into office. To this end, a short time ago, I signed a new executive order to ensure that when it comes to essential medicines, we buy American. The executive order will require that U.S. government agencies purchase all essential medicines that we need from American sources. The executive order will also sweep away unnecessary regulatory barriers to domestic pharmaceutical production and support advanced manufacturing processes that will keep our drug prices low and allow American companies to compete on the world stage. We'll be able to compete on the world stage, but we're now going to have the lowest prices as opposed to by far the highest prices. I have people that I know that go to Canada. They go to Canada to buy drugs, to buy prescription drugs. They go there because the price is so much lower than the United States. And yet it's made by the same company, often in the same plant. It's a disgrace. And the politicians allowed this to happen for many, many decades. You have people called middlemen. I don't know who the middlemen are. I don't know. They never say middle women, so they're politically not correct. But I've heard the term middlemen for a long time. They are so wealthy. They are so wealthy. Nobody has any idea who the hell they are, what they do. They make more money than the drug companies. You know, in all fairness, at least the drug companies have to produce a product, and it has to be a good product. But the middlemen, well, the rebate that I'm doing cuts out the middlemen and it reduces costs, and the money goes back to the people purchasing the drugs. So I have a lot of enemies out there. This may be the last time you'll see me for a while. A lot of very, very rich enemies, but they are not happy with what I'm doing. But I figure we have one chance to do it, and no other president's going to do what I do. No other president would do a favored nations, a rebate, a buy from other nations at much less cost. Nobody. And there are a lot of unhappy people, and they're very rich people, and they're very unhappy.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground, and I won't back down.